Transmitiendo desde la Universidad de Yale en Estados Unidos, esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
Ustedes viendo este programa, sean ustedes bienvenidos a otra emisión aquí en Proyecto Grado Cero. Y hoy tenemos un gran invitado. Hoy vamos a continuar con esta serie de invitados importantes y de ideas que son necesarias esparcir. Y tenemos el privilegio de platicar con el doctor Bruce Ackerman, profesor de la Universidad de Yale. Thank you, Professor Ackerman.
It's a pleasure.
First of all, Professor Ackerman, I got a question for you. In your book, The Decline and Fall of the Republican American Republic, is a quite interesting book in which you throw the hypothesis that the presidential figure is kind of damaging the idea of the republic. Can you explain us why do you think this is a problem?
Well, let's go back one step. The Republic, the American Republic, like the Mexican Republic, like the French Republic, are born in revolutions. We have in, and of course also Bolivar, these nations emerge out of the age of Enlightenment revolution. Then constitutionalize their achievements. Of course, you have 1824, but in more in particular, in your case, we have 1857 in Benito Juarez, who's very much in the spirit of the radical revolutionaries of that bring Abraham Lincoln to power. And later on, in 1870 in France, we have, again, a republic coming out of bottom-up activity. The it is of great importance in the American tradition that we have a Republican general, George Washington, who voluntarily refuses to run for a third term. The American Federation that is born out of the Republic, the first American Revolution, and the second American Revolution, which is the Civil War, the central government is very weak. In 1877, Congress passes a law restricting the standing army of the United States to 60,000 men. 60,000 solamente. A big country.
Yes.
All right. The president of the republic in 1932, when there's Herbert Hoover, who is president during the Depression, has three secretaries. Nothing more. And by secretaries, I mean secretaries. He has no staff. This is very unlike the strong presidential model of the Mexican revolution yes. of Suarez, and then, you know, in 1917, and the PRI tradition, where we have this strong presidentialism even more. The 1930s, we have Cárdenas and Roosevelt. Very similar ideas. Not radically different. There are differences we can... Roosevelt does not nationalize the oil industry, but he creates national units to provide power to the country. So for the first time in 1939, the President of the United States begins to have a staff. He has six special assistants. Between, then we have the Second World War, the rise of the United States as the hegemonic power of the world. This was not true before. With an enormous standing army. Not true before. The Army of the United States on the eve of the Second World War, on the eve of the Second World War, is 100,000 men. The army of France is in the millions. So for the first time after the Second World War, we have this enormous military establishment. The creation of a National Security Council, then later on, the creation of a domestic council for the president. What is going on here is the president becomes in charge of an enormous staff. He has his own lawyers for the first time in the White House who interpret the law in his favor systematically.
Obviously.
Not irresponsible. Many of my students are, the Yale Law School teaches these people. But one administration builds on the next administration. It is not as if President Obama has repudiated the executive interpretations of George Bush. He has repudiated a few of them. So we don't torture. This is great. But that's only one of many, many things. So we have... With the rise of the activist welfare state in America, just as with the rise after Cárdenas of an activist welfare state in Mexico, same is true in France, the enormous bureaucratic apparatus which is enhancing presidential power. Then we have a second feature, which is the rise of the political primary system. It used to be that the Democratic candidate for president and the Republican candidate for president were selected by state political leaders who were concerned first and foremost with winning the election in their state. They wanted someone who would appeal to the middle. After 1968, there was the transformation so that we have a primary system where activists, both on the left and on the right, select the presidential candidates. And most of the middle don't participate. They have the right to participate, but they await till the fall election. So this is a new structure that permits radical left, radical right to select presidential candidates. Then, so the scenario that is dangerous, it has not really yet happened. I mean, I have opinions on George W. Bush or Obama. I'm not interested at the present time to present you my opinions on politics. I'm interested in these structural points. There is a very serious risk that a candidate selected by relative extremists, maybe both on both sides, will then come, get one of them will win, then use the tremendous power that has been accumulated as a result of the rise of American government, both abroad and at home. The president, by executive order, can unilaterally act in very bad ways, and his legal White House counsel will say it's legal. Then maybe the Supreme Court will intervene 5 years later, because it takes a long time, or maybe they won't. In the meantime, we have a dangerous possibility here. And so I have proposed reforms to try to respond to this, which is a danger regardless of if you're a Democrat.
Yes.
This is a danger right now. There's a bigger right-wing danger. 15 years from now, there might be a bigger left-wing danger. Who knows? But the important point is to remain, keep the president under presidency under control. I myself believe that in Mexico, for example, it was very unfortunate not to rewrite the Constitution. We have this excellent, I'm a great admirer of the 1917 Constitution. But of course, for a very long period, it was not too important. It was, you know, the no re-election, giving the power to shift the politicians from House to Senate to President to back and forth to the governorship, et cetera, and so forth. When we actually had this opening from election day under Salinas, where somehow there was a computer error,
yes.
The tragedy of 2006, which is still to me really much worse than Bush against Gore, much worse. A terribly important aim should be to bring the presidency under control, have a parliamentary system with different institutions checking the parliament. As I suggest, there is a book of mine translated into Spanish called The New Separation of Powers, but I don't want to go in that direction. That's a long answer to
actually,
a single question.
in this book and in The Decline and Fall of the Republican System, you propose the idea that we should create new check and balances.
Absolutely.
Like what?
Well, we already have some in Mexico. They didn't work too well. The Electoral Commission, on paper, is a great institution. This is a new check and balance. I happened to be a serious representative for Al Gore in Florida in 2006. And I was presenting my arguments on Al Gore's behalf before the Florida legislature. And then there was a big press conference afterwards. I said, you know, if we don't have an election commission, independent election commission in America. That's why Florida was so terrible. The Secretary of State, you know, Montesquieu told us there is the executive, there is the legislative, there is the judicial. That's it. Why is that it? I suppose because of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, or something like that. I mean, that this is, it's not obvious that there should be three. What we have is an independent, in Mexico, by 2000, you had an independent electoral commission. Not only in Mexico, 80 countries in the world. We don't. So I came out and said, you know, if we continue to allow a partisan Secretary of State to count the votes, this is disgraceful. You know, we're going to be a banana republic. I got all my friends from Latin America saying, what do you mean banana republic? We have an election commission. You don't. You're the, you know. So that's an example of a separate power. Should there be an anti-corruption commission, which is independent? I say yes. And it used to, there was a time when Singapore and Hong Kong was extremely corrupt. They created an independent anti-corruption commission. They give them very high salaries. They say they never work for anyone else. And if you're ever caught corrupt, you lose $400,000 a year salary. You lose everything. They're honest. And Hong Kong is now one of the most honest countries in the world. In India, which is very corrupt, they run honest elections. Why? There's an independent election commission. So we should have a parliamentary system. Maybe we should have an independent bank. You know, there should be independent entities where the central institutions will fail systematically. So we have to rethink the basic design. Instead, we have in Mexico three major parties. This almost guarantees that no president is going to get 50% of the vote on the first go-round. You know, el mandatorio has no mandate.
Yes.
And he encounters a legislature which is not interested in, is interested in undermining him. He then has the incentive to use unilateral power. This is the, what I call the Linz nightmare. Juan Linz, I'm a student in this of Juan Linz, who is a great political scientist who really has studied much more than I, the Latin American experience, and this goes on again and again and again. So we should have a new separation of powers. If you had had in Mexico, for example, right now, a parliamentary system, you'd have what? You'd have PRI having 40% of the vote, 35% of the vote, PAN, 35% of the vote, the left party, what is it? The PRD, another 25, 30%. Rather than, and they would form coalitions toward the center.
Yes.
In this system, the PRD is being excluded, et cetera, and so forth. This is all, the El Mandatorio is ascendant. Well, this is not the way to run a democratic system, either in America or in Mexico.
I don't know if it's my impression, but when I read your book, The Failing of the Founding Fathers, it together with the first book we talk about, it's my impression that you don't like the figure of the presidential democracy. You don't like the whole idea. You're more parliamentarist than presidential.
The American system was parliamentarist, with very rare exceptions, until the 1930s. Woodrow Wilson, who was really a great man, was a great scholar before he became president of the United States. He wrote a book called Congressional Government, saying, forget about what these people in 1790 thought. We have a system of congressional government. The president has very little power, which was true of his time. The chairman of the committees and the particular bureaucracy, whether it's interior or defense or whatever, they are engaged in their own deal making, and the president has very little power. That was the standard situation. America fought a revolution against whom? The king. Yes. They did not want to have a president who was the king. That's why that was what the revolution was about. In 1808, that isn't what the revolution in Mexico is about. Vive el rey, which is the rey. Yes. In 1808. It's only with eight, really. Well, we can, you know, Mexican history better than me, but let's say we can, you know, by the time we get to the 1840s, we'll say the imperial notion is on decline or something like that. It's only really 1857, and then when you have the Austrian prince come in, then we get, you know, a real republicanism. The Americans have this republicanism early, and they don't like the king. George Washington is a victorious general, but he is not a dictator. This is not what he's into. sometimes there is such a thing as a great man. It is not the case that the system was more congressional centered for much more time than we imagine, because of course all of us, you and me, think of the United States of America not as a republic of settlers from Europe who are killing Indians. That's what's going on. You know, one of the important differences between the United States and Mexico is that the English destroy the natives. The Spanish exploit the natives by sending them to the gold mines, but they don't destroy them. That's a very big difference. But this is an agrarian republic, and we think of America today as, you know, the greatest power in the world. And it's very recent. I'm sorry.
I read once that you say that in the United States, there is not one constitution, but three constitutions.
That's right.
But in even you think there are three, you have still, let me put it this way, the fear that they become, like LaSalle used to say, paper constitutions. Could you explain us these three constitutions?
Well, I wouldn't, let's think of it generationally. Every generation in the United States since the Revolution looks around and thinks their parents have done a terrible job. And they mobilize to transform the system. Sometimes they win. This happens at the American Revolution and the Constitution. And then we have a set of revolutionary heroes becoming president. There's the general. Then there is John Adams, the diplomat of the revolution. Then there's Thomas Jefferson, the intellectual of the revolution. Then there's James Madison, who is a wimp. No, he is a nerd. He's the principal nerd. And then you have Monroe, who is the last revolutionary hero standing, and he's walking around, and people are, you know, expanding and building railroads, and then they run out. And we have another revolution against the banks. This is Andrew Jackson. There is a financial power in Washington yet, but in Philadelphia, that's strangling ordinary farmers and working people. He wins. He doesn't have as big a revolution as the Civil War, which is the beginning of the Second Republic, you see, which, you know, ends slavery and has radical aspirations that are then cut back because the central government isn't strong enough, so the racists in the South strike back. Then we have the third great revolution, I'm skipping here, the economic disaster of the Great Depression. The failure of, the obvious failure of the free market system to operate. I would like to, maybe I'll run out of time beforehand, but I would very much like to write a book comparing Cardenas, Roosevelt, Léon Blum, the government in England, the Adolf Hitler, Joseph Stalin, all of them are responding to the same economic crisis and transforming the system. How are they similar? How are they different? The answer is they're similar in some ways and different in a lot of ways, and we would be very interesting to find out, you know, what's different about them. I think that there are many similarities in Léon Blum and the U.S. case and Cardenas. Of course, there are many differences too. Anyway, this introduces in the United States the New Deal Republic, in which there is an activist, redistributive state at the center with a big bureaucracy, which has certain pathologies, the presidentialist temptation that I'm describing, but has many benefits. What I want to do is to keep the benefits and constrain presidentialism. And then, of course, we have this book that you have here, The Civil Rights Revolution, which is volume 3, another dimension of the egalitarian revolution, you see. The New Deal is trying to redistribute to the poor. As part of its bargain with the South, which is part of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's coalition, central part of his coalition, they define the welfare state in ways that exclude black people. So, for example, we have a social security system that is enacted in 1935, which is really quite admirable. Honest, you know, there are tens of millions of people getting their checks as we talk. It's defined, so in 1935, to exclude agricultural workers, meaning blacks and Mexicans, and servants, meaning blacks and Mexicans. So forget about them, but for white people, it's fine.
It's okay. Right.
Now, this is where we really have a fundamental transformation here. The system that brought us the welfare state and not only pensions for really universal pensions, basically, for any worker, but also collective bargaining rights in the National Labor Relations Act, new controls on capitalism, the Securities and Exchange Commission. This is a very substantial revolution here. Of an altogether familiar kind. Similar things are happening throughout the world. But so far as it's for white people. Now, how did it happen that this revolution is then complemented by the Civil Rights Revolution? You know, in 1965, America does not have universal suffrage. Black people are not voting. The number of people who are black and voting in Mississippi in 1964 is less than 1,000. 1,000 people, less than that. By 19, the percentage of black people in the South who are going to white schools 10 years after Brown against Board of Education, which declares integrated schools, you know, as required by the Constitution, 2% of blacks' children are going to white schools in the South in 1964. By 1973, as a result of the mobilized coalition of white people and black people, the Chicanos come in toward the end, but they're there. The Mexicans come in through, you know, with, I mean, in California, coming in toward the end. The South is the most integrated schools in the country in 8 years. Not because of the court. The court is important. The court puts this issue on the agenda. Race is put on the agenda by the early movement, but really the court. The Democrats don't want to talk about it because it'll split the coalition. The coalition is between the Southerners and the immigrants against the people who won the Civil War, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants who remained Republicans, but they're not any longer winning because of the economic crisis. The Democrats are not interested in raising the race issue. It'll destroy their coalition. And the Republicans are now a party of big business. Many of them remember the days when they were the party of Lincoln, but that's not important to them. So the court putting it on the agenda is very important, but it would not have happened without the mobilized bottom-up effort of the American people, led by people like Martin Luther King, in coalition with Lyndon Johnson, who, you see, John F. Kennedy was very charismatic, but he didn't care much about race. He cared about the Cold War. But Lyndon Johnson gets into his political career. He first begins his work as a school teacher of Mexican kids. Mexican-American, Mexican-Mexican. It wasn't so clear to him. He didn't care. And then he becomes a member of the youth projects of the New Deal. Then he wins election in 1937 as a congressman. He is a classic New Dealer who then suddenly sees this great opportunity because of the assassin's bullet to join forces with Martin Luther King, who is interested not only in racial equality, but the war on poverty. And what happens, you see, and Lyndon Johnson also very much is dedicated to the war on poverty for a political reason. He knows that if it's only black people, he will lose the whites of the South. He very famously, today is the day the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which transforms the constitutional situation and is absolutely essential for integration in the workplace, integration in schools, integration in restaurants. Absolutely. Without this, it would never have happened. It was signed 50 years and one day ago today. This is July 3rd. Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of July 2nd, and he turns to the very proud people, and he says, unless we do more, I have now destroyed the Democratic Party. The Southern whites are going to desert us. And he wants to say, no, Southern whites, it isn't only about race. It's about poverty. You are the poorest people. The South is the poorest region of the country. Let's move on from race to poverty, and that fails in this period. We are still, so I'm very much in favor at the present time of changing our agenda, not forgetting the achievements of the civil rights movement, but moving back to the question of economic inequality as the next revolutionary mobilization for the next generation. I'm not going to be around, but the next generation. Yes. But that's what I very much am in favor of. But please, I'm answering too long. I'm giving you too long answers to your good, short questions.
you started writing this trilogy, these three books, with the people since the late 70s. Three books in which you pick several stages of history in the United States. In this late book, you have a very beautiful detail. And I believe that one is for friendship and the other one is because the character he has in the transformation of law in the 1960s. You dedicate this book to Owen Fisk.
Yes.
I believe it's for friendship and also for the role he played in the transformation of the rights in the United States, isn't it?
Well, the Owen and I disagree. I mean, Owen and I have been great. Both of us came to the Yale Law School at the same time, and we've had this fabulous relationship. And you know, the Yale Law School, we've been very lucky in the Yale Law School. This has been a place full of ideas, and I have much to thank Owen for. Without him, I certainly, it isn't friendship, it's, you know, without his ongoing conversations, I would never have moved in this direction. I disagree with Owen. Owen exaggerates the power of courts. I emphasize that the great engine of American politics is what I call the movement party, which in every generation, we now have the Tea Party. I'm against the Tea Party. It's the same thing. All the people up in Washington don't know what they're talking about. We, the people, have to organize and win election after election until we finally gain control of all of the elements of the separation of powers, and then we will revolutionize the system. Revolutions for me are not things like Maoist total destructions or, you know, Trotsky's permanent revolution or Lenin. These are not, those are pathologies of revolution. It's the tradition represented by the 1917 Constitution or the Civil Rights Revolution. These are the great rebirths of the Enlightenment tradition of liberal, egalitarian, social, democratic republics. And it is wrong to suppose that, I'm very critical of people who think that really what the American founding fathers did is design a perfect machine and that everybody will simply, you know, it will, even though everyone is selfish and self-interested, the machine will work. This is not my vision of the success of the American system insofar as it's been successful. It's been one after another, sometimes bloody revolution, as in Civil War, as in the American Revolution. These are called revolution. You know, they people killed each other. Yes. But in the 20th century, peaceful but mobilizations of the broad scale, with some degree of violence, but nothing comparable, which have renewed the system. The art of law and legal intellectuals is to try to shape these forces for good, not for destruction. And to recognize that there are always pathologies, because you see, these systems aren't designed by God. They happen, and of course, there are going to be weaknesses. And the challenge for the next generation is to fix those, even though you know that there are weaknesses that you don't, that you're creating without even knowing it, you know.
At the end of this book, you get to a really beautiful idea of working in a living constitution.
Yes.
How can we make a living constitution?
Well, you see, the living constitution is a slogan which has two different, really very different ideas in it. For most people who say that they are living constitutionalists. They are people like Owen Fiss and people who are court-centered. Who is the life of the living constitution? The answer is the courts slowly adapting to new phenomena. So let's take, for example, the question of gay marriage. This is a beautiful case in for the court-centered living constitution. Social mores are changing, and the politicians are a little, don't know what to do. You see, like Obama was very cagey for a long time. And of course, other people are even less cagey. They denounce it and things like this. The society is moving on, and the courts, especially common law courts, much less civilian courts, like in Mexico, but more common law courts, adapt. That's one kind of living constitution. Listen, and I'm in favor of that to some degree. For me, the great point is that we can have these revolutions on a human scale, as in the Civil Rights Revolution or the New Deal Revolution, without formally changing the text of the Constitution. But through other things like statutes. A creation of new bureaucratic institutions. So when we ask about Pemex, is that part of the living constitution of Mexico? That's what the debate is about. I don't want to.
Yes, get into.
That's part of, and did that just sort of sneak up? No, Cárdenas, did it on purpose through a self-conscious mobilization. You know, now how should the debate over its deconstruction or whether it should be sustained and modified? How should it be conducted? My basic, you know, I'm not a master of Mexican history, you know, I know,
but you know,
but in a comparable case as in the United States, I would say the same way it came into being, the same kind of mobilized, self-conscious debate, rather than how can we, nothing is forever, should the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which finally, in the real world, granted blacks voting power in Mississippi, within 5 years, the percentages of black people actually voting skyrocketed because of federal intervention. If we want to repeal the Voting Rights Act, it should be done in the same way that it was enacted, through a popular movement. I would oppose it, but instead, the Supreme Court of the United States last year declared, of all things, unconstitutional a key provision of the Voting Rights Act because it was against its understanding of the Reconstruction Amendments of the 1860s. I deny that's true, but even if it were true, a later generation in the 1960s repudiated those limiting principles of the 1860s. And for the court, nine people by a vote of five to four, repudiating a key element of the Civil Rights Revolution, this is fundamentally against the principles of American constitutionalism. But this is popular living constitutionalism, not court-centered. Then how to relate the two, fascinating question.
And what do we have still, what do we have yet from the Civil Rights Revolution, and what do we have forgotten of this movement in America?
We have to take a distinction between ordinary people and the legal profession. You know, America has very few holidays. This is one big difference to Mexico.
Every month we have one.
We have very few holidays. We made Martin Luther King Day a holiday. How did we do that? We're efficient people. We eliminated one holiday. There used to be a three civic holidays of the Republic. July 4th, the Declaration of Independence, Washington's birthday, and Lincoln's birthday. In order to make Martin Luther King into this, we put together Washington and Lincoln. It's now called President's Day. So we still have three holidays, but Martin Luther King is understood. Amazing, you see, because he wasn't anything. He was not an official. As equal to these historic great presidents, who were in fact great.
Yes.
And you know who signed this into law? Ronald Reagan. Really the Civil Rights Revolution is sort of like your Constitution of 1917. It resonates. Without the Civil Rights Revolution achievement, we would not have had the second generation of feminism, gay marriage, and all of this. This also was independently struggled for, but the paradigm was the Civil Rights Revolution. Now, the question is, how will the courts, the first mission of the courts is to remember these great achievements of the American people and preserve them, even when, as most of the time it happens, normal politics goes on in very different ways. The politicians aren't that interested in ideology. They're interested in gaining re-election. They're making deals. This is nothing terrible. This is what normal politics is like. But from time to time, Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson were not normal politicians. And the job of the courts is to preserve them. That's why the last chapter of this book is called Betrayal? Because there are many signs of that the present court may well be in an escalating betrayal, not only of the Civil Rights Revolution, but the New Deal Revolution. So, for example, by a vote of 5-4, court upheld the constitutionality of President Obama's medical care system. 5-4. This is an obvious application of basic New Deal principles, but they didn't see it that way. They thought it was a very hard case. And with the Voting Rights Act, they went even further and repudiated a central achievement of the Civil Rights Revolution. And Justice Roberts says, oh, we're beyond that. And then immediately we see state after state restricting the suffrage in ways that are going to have adverse consequences for black people and poor people, Mexican Americans and such. It's just happening all around the country. Now, this is wrong in a way that, we'll see who, that's my argument.
Finally, you just gave me the news that these three books with the people going to be translated into Spanish, which is a great news for all the people that want to read these books that are really good. And what is next in your work?
Well, the book that I'm working on now is A Theory of World Constitutionalism. How many different kinds of constitutionalisms are there? What are the pathways to constitutionalism? There is the revolutionary pathway followed by many countries. then there are countries that think that these are constitutions in which outsiders become insiders and then use the Constitution to state the principles that they will not betray. Then we have, from the French Revolution onward, a very different kind of constitutionalism. The easiest case to appreciate is the British case. The British were against the French Revolution. They were against Napoleon. They've been against revolution from then to now. They are insiders, and what they do, but they have a constitution. What they do is try to deflect outsiders by pragmatic concessions without necessarily principles. So that's insider evolutionary constitutionalism. And then we have elite bargain constitutions. So, for example, consider Spain. We have Franco dies. Suarez, who's very young at that time, and the king, who is also very young, they know one thing. Let's not have another Spanish Civil War. Let's not have a big mobilization. Moreover, they get in touch with the communist boss. He says, you're right. Let's not have another civil war. We have an elite bargain between insiders and outsiders. Chile is another example. Brazil. This is very much in the spirit of Max Weber. Max Weber, you know, has these ideal types of legitimation.
Yes.
But constitutionalism is not on the list. So what I'm doing is trying to rethink Max Weber with constitutionalism as the central mode of legitimation in a vast array of countries, and use then chapter case studies of different countries, not to exhaust the complexity of Mexico, or right now I'm finishing South Africa, but rather to invite people who, of course, know so much more than I could possibly about South Africa or India or the French Fourth and Fifth Republics, or, you know, Germany, Japan. You know, I'm a lucky fellow. You know, they pay me, and they don't ask me to do very much other than read books. So that's what I do. And so then I can invite you to say, well, you know, how is Mandela similar and different to Nehru? How is Suarez similar or different from Lincoln? And it's quite rewarding. At least I hope so. And of course, I'll make a lot of mistakes, but because how much, you know, I can get away with it, you know, and people will get promoted by saying that I'm wrong. This has been a path to great professorial success in the past, so that we can continue that. And you know, 20 years from now, we'll have more genuine comparative understanding and a conversation about constitutionalism that is more sophisticated than today. At least I hope so.
Well, Professor Ackerman, it has been a pleasure to talk
with you. Oh, it's a pleasure.